Hello and welcome to the Siegel Rare Neuroimmune Association's Ask the Expert podcast series. This episode is titled Open Q&A on MOG Antibody Disease, or MOGAD. My name is Chrissy Ilger, and I moderated this episode. Today, I am pleased to be joined by Dr. John Chen. Dr. Chen serves as a consultant and professor of ophthalmology and neurology and neuro-ophthalmology fellowship director at the Mayo Clinic. You can find his full bio in the podcast description. SRNA is a nonprofit focused on support, education, and research of rare neuroimmune disorders. You can learn more about us on our website at wearesrna.org. This episode is made possible in part by the generous support of Amgen, Alexion AstraZeneca Rare Disease, Genentech, and UCB. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Chen.
Yeah, thanks so much for inviting me to join you all today.
Great. So can you begin by briefly explaining what MOG antibody disease is?
Yes, so MOG antibody disease, or MOGAD, is essentially a disease where you have inflammation of various parts of the brain, including the optic nerve of the brain or the spinal cord. And it's associated with antibodies against MOG, myelin oligodendrocyte glycoprotein, which is essentially this protein found on the myelin. It, again, can cause inflammation of any part of the central nervous system. It can kind of mimic multiple sclerosis, which we've known about for, you know, over a century. And then after multiple sclerosis, we realized that this other condition called neuromyelitis optica, NMO, was a separate disease, which is antibodies against aquaporin 4. And then now, just more recently, since around 2015 or so, we've recognized that there's a separate entity, MOGAD, with these antibodies against MOG. And what's important about differentiating these different conditions is it's a different pathophysiology. You know, this, it's acting through the MOG antibodies. And it's important because the prognosis is different between these three entities. And even more importantly, the treatments are different. And so it's important for us to understand, when you have a patient with transverse myelitis or a patient with optic neuritis, we want to look for these conditions because it allows us to dictate how we're going to treat patients.
Great, thank you. So what causes MOG antibody disease?
To be honest, we actually still don't know. It's an autoimmune process, and about a third of patients have a prior infection of some kind, like a viral illness. And the thought is that the immune system revs up to fight off infections and things like that. And for some patients, we don't know the trigger, the reason, but these antibodies against MOG get developed, and then your own immune system is attacking parts of the brain, the optic nerve, the spinal cord in that way. We don't know the exact reason or why it happens.
Thank you. So how is MOGAD diagnosed?
Essentially, you have to have an inflammation of parts of the brain, most commonly optic nerve with optic neuritis. Especially in children, you get inflammation of the brain called ADEM. Transverse myelitis is another common way, cortical encephalitis. So you have these ways that MOG can cause inflammation in various parts of the brain, spinal cord, optic nerves. And then you have to have the antibodies against MOG present in the blood, or in a small subset of patients, you'll have antibodies just in the cerebral spinal fluid on a spinal tap, but usually in the blood. And so by definition, it's MOG antibody-associated disease, so you have to have the MOG antibodies present to have that diagnosis of MOGAD.
Got it. So what acute treatments are used during a MOGAD attack?
Early steroids, high dose, is certainly thought to be very beneficial, and earlier the better. And the high-dose steroids usually is in the form of IV methylprednisolone, so essentially getting these infusions of high doses of IV steroids for 3 to 5 days. You can also do very high doses of oral prednisone pills, but the bioequivalent is 1,250 milligrams of prednisone. And since the biggest prednisone tablet we can have is 50 milligrams, it's actually 25 tablets all at once, which you can do for 3 to 5 days. And then with MOG, it's important because sometimes it's not only steroid response if it's steroid dependent. And so we tend to do an oral prednisone taper over 1 to 2 months, because sometimes if you just treat them with steroids and then stop the steroids, they can have a relapse. Because again, the inflammation just hadn't fully been controlled with the steroids. So essentially high dose steroids for 3 to 5 days, and then oral prednisone taper over 1 to 2 months. There's some patients with really severe attacks where the steroids actually doesn't lead to enough recovery. And then we'll do this extra treatment called plasma exchange, where oftentimes it requires a central line where they actually get a line into their jugular vein, and we actually can take the blood, wash out the pathologic antibodies and inflammation, and then give back plasma. So essentially to wash out the pathologic antibodies. But that's a little bit more of involved treatment. Only about 10% of attacks, up to 20% of attacks for MOG need that plasma exchange. But it's something that certainly it's an option if they don't respond to steroids. And in terms of the timing of that, it's hard to know exactly when to pull the trigger in terms of giving, you know, more days of steroids to see if it's going to recover, or when do we switch over to plasma exchange. And that part's still kind of getting worked out. And there's actually a randomized clinical trial called Timely Plex that we're co-leading with Johns Hopkins to try and answer that question. So if we have time, maybe we could even chat about that clinical trial some in the future too.
Definitely. Someone just put in the chat, and I think this is a common, I guess, concern with steroids is possible weight gain. Can you talk a little bit about that and if it's usually temporary or what can be done about that?
Yeah, no, steroids have a lot of side effects. In the acute setting, they're not too bad. You know, that 5 days, 3 days of high-dose steroids, that's not going to cause the weight gain. But it's the long-term steroid use that causes weight gain. It causes thinning of the bones. It can often cause diabetes. And these are drawbacks. And that's why we look for, if a patient is steroid dependent, like every time we come off steroids, they have a relapse. That's why we tend to switch over to other medications to get patients off the steroids. Because again, steroids have lots of side effects. On the acute setting, it's not so bad. Again, it's going to cause acid reflux, difficulty sleeping, mood changes. Very rarely, it can cause these even strokes to the bone called avascular necrosis, which we can't predict. But usually in the acute setting, 5 days of steroids, 2 weeks of steroids, it's not too bad. But long term, MOG responds very, very well to steroids, but we can't just put patients on steroids for, you know, 3 years. It just causes too many side effects. So that's why we switch over to more chronic immunotherapy if they continue to have relapses every time we taper off the steroids.
Got it. Thank you. So will MOGAD testing results be affected by concurrent IV steroids being administered or any other of the acute therapies that you mentioned?
Potentially a little bit. The steroids probably not as much, but the plasma exchange certainly probably can. At least for about a month, essentially, we're washing out the pathologic antibodies, including the MOG antibodies and all the cytokines, inflammatory markers. So I do think plasma exchange can certainly influence it. Sometimes acute treatments can also include IVIG, even though that's more commonly used for chronic immunotherapy. Sometimes we use it for acute treatment. That may not have as much of an influence on the MOG antibodies. But the thought is that any acute treatment and any potential chronic treatment can influence it just a touch. At plasma exchange will probably be your biggest one.
Got it. So what are the currently available long-term therapies for MOGAD? And does this differ by location, for example, the United States versus Europe or Asia?
That's certainly still evolving. What we know is some of the traditional medications for MS are not effective. And when we first knew about MOGAD, we essentially took all the treatments we used for NMO and essentially used them for MOGAD. And so we're using Celcept, Imuran, Rituximab. Those are kind of some of the commonly old traditional medications used for NMO. Those all probably kind of work for MOGAD, but not as well. Rituximab, which depletes these B cells in your immune system, is very effective for NMO, but just doesn't seem to work quite as well for MOGAD. And again, the thought is it's just a different pathophysiology, different disease process. So some treatments that we think may work a little better are IVIG or sub-Q IG. And the dosing actually matters. We essentially found with these multi-center studies is that IVIG, if given at a very high dose or high frequency, is very, very effective. But given at a low dose or low frequency, doesn't seem to work as well. Sub-Q IG, essentially, you take your IG and you put it through the skin. These infusions that can take 2 to 3 hours a week can be very effective because you're getting it every week instead of every month. So with IVIG, you get these kind of spikes in your IG levels, but then they can taper down, and then it kind of goes up and down. With sub-Q IG every week, it tends to be very effective because you kind of have that more stable level. So those are some treatments that, again, we don't use for MS or NMO, but it seems to be effective for MOGAD. The other pathway that seems to be effective is blocking this IL-6 pathway. And so there's satralizumab and tocilizumab, both shown to be effective for NMO, and they seem to be quite effective for MOGAD as well. There's currently a clinical trial on satralizumab, again, an IL-6 blocker, and the results will be officially released at the American Academy of Neurology, so very, very soon, in the next couple of weeks, but it looks very promising. And then there's another ongoing clinical trial blocking Fc receptor. It's an Fc receptor inhibitor. Essentially, it's again trying to remove pathologic antibodies, and we don't know the results of that clinical trial, but we hope that that'll be effective and then give us FDA-approved medications. So we're learning a lot about treatments for MOGAD. Our knowledge for MOGAD is about, 10 years behind NMO, but we're catching up, and hopefully in the next couple of years, we'll have FDA-approved medications and more clinical trials.
Yeah, we're looking forward to learning what the research will show and hopefully, as you mentioned, new therapies in the near future. We got a question, and this is a specific case, but I think it can be maybe applicable more broadly. But this person was diagnosed with idiopathic TM in 2019. They've had slight relapses, but yearly MRIs showed no brain involvement, no optic nerve involvement. They have never tested positive for MOG or aquaporin-4, but in 2025, they had antibiotics that apparently triggered spinal lesions. Once they had their labs done again, MOG was positive. Their question is, with no optic nerve, no brain, and only spinal cord lesions, and a MOG positive test, is that enough to diagnose MOG versus TM? And I guess also more broadly, how do these shifts in MOG levels, how does that correlate to diagnosis?
Yeah, it's again, with any, if let's say you have an attack initially and you're MOG antibody negative, if you have a new attack, it's important to check again for MOG or aquaporin-4 antibodies, especially if it's transverse myelitis. Again, the first attack, perhaps the blood draw would have been done later after the attack, and we know MOG antibodies can slightly decline over time. It could have been after steroids, plasma exchange, all these things that can kind of wash out the antibodies. So if you have a new attack, again, it's important to check again. If it's aquaporin-4 positive on the cell-based assay, that's your diagnosis of NMO. The animal antibody against aquaporin-4 is essentially perfect if it's a cell-based live assay. The problem about the MOG antibodies is they're not perfect. They're pretty good. They're 98% specific if done with a live cell-based assay. So that's really good compared to, we have this marker against lupus called ANA. It's only 80% specific. So 20% of normal people actually just have this antibody floating around, or antibodies against ANA. So that's not helpful. But MOG, it's 98% specific, pretty good. The drawback is MOG is pretty rare relatively compared to MS and other diseases. And so if you've got a disease that's relatively uncommon and you have a test that's not 100% perfect, you can get false positives. And so I would say with that patient, I would look at the MOG antibody titer and make sure it's done on a cell-based assay, ideally a live cell-based assay rather than these fixed dead cells. The live part actually makes the assay a little bit better. And if it's a high titer, even though it's just transverse myelitis, that makes your diagnosis of MOGAD. If it's, let's say, a very low titer, typically what we want to confirm it's a diagnosis of MOGAD is these clinical features or radiologic features that help you say it's MOGAD as opposed to MS or something else. For MOGAD, in terms of the transverse myelitis, it tends to be longer segments of inflammation of the spinal cord than multiple sclerosis, where the lesions are much smaller. So that's something that can help. With MOGAD, it tends to affect kind of the central gray of the spinal cord. And so if you look at the spinal cord and axial cut, it'll actually look like an H in terms of the inflammation. So that's something we look for. And then lastly, one way to kind of help differentiate MS from MOGAD is MS stands for multiple sclerosis or multiple scars. And with MS, it's interesting. When you get this inflammation, you get these little scars, and then they persist on the MRI that you do later. And then you get a new lesion, and then you get a new scar, and you get multiple scars that just keep persisting. With MOGAD, with the inflammatory attacks, you get a lot of inflammation, but about 80% of the lesions actually shrink and sometimes even disappear. And so repeat MRIs to show that these lesions that you get, these acute attacks, that they're disappearing, that's another sign that's MOGAD. So I know it's a long answer for this particular question, but there's a lot of nuances, but very well, just because it's transverse myelitis, that very, very well could be MOGAD. It just depends on the titer, what it looked like on radiology.
Got it. Thank you. Another question that came in: could MOGAD cause one of your eyes to have trouble opening after being asleep, either laying down or sitting up? Or is this condition more dry eye related? This person says, my MOGAD diagnosis came from optic neuritis in the right eye with temporary loss of vision.
Yeah, MOGAD itself wouldn't cause inability to open one eye. And so that's going to be something else. If it's only upon awakening, there's a very interesting condition called apraxia of eyelid opening upon awakening, where essentially patients wake up and they're just unable to open one eye. It's fortunately, it's not a dangerous condition. And we don't know the exact cause for it. One thought is it's actually dry eye, sort of like it's difficult to open a peanut butter jar. You know, if you're trying to trying and then you pop it open and it stays open. That's the thought, is the eye is just dry and it's kind of crusted shut and you just have difficulty opening. And once you get it up, it's okay. The other thought is when we're asleep, our brain actually is essentially paralyzed. You know, we don't want us running around and enacting our dreams. And the thought is, you know, that just the eyelid itself is still essentially asleep for, you know, 5 minutes or so. And it just requires some time to kind of wake up. But it's not going to be MOGAD. But again, if it's only upon awakening, it's probably this condition called apraxia of eyelid opening upon awakening.
It's really interesting, and thank you for sharing. I hope that person's able to look into that. Is having vision coming and going normal while on IVIG and IV steroids?
Not from the treatment itself. Coming and going can mean a lot of different things. I'm not entirely sure by coming and going, you know, how fast it's coming and going. So sometimes with the MOG, you can get a pretty swollen optic nerve. And if you get a swollen optic nerve, sometimes if it's swollen enough, if you stand up too quickly, your vision will actually black out for a second or two. So it could be from a lot of optic nerve swelling. If it's a much slower process, you know, it could be inflammation that's being controlled, not being controlled, but that's, you know, we're talking about days and weeks as opposed to minutes and hours. If it's heat induced or exercise induced, there's this condition called Uthoff's phenomenon, where essentially if you have a prior optic neuritis, if you get too hot or if you exercise, it actually slows the signal down along the optic nerve, and you'll get transient blurring of your vision in that eye, in the affected eye with prior optic neuritis. Again, not related to treatment or IVIG. So I think I just have to a little more details in terms of how fast the vision's kind of coming and going. But the treatment itself shouldn't cause the vision to go in and out.
Got it. Does the amount of MOG antibodies found on testing correlate to the severity of an attack or of the long-term course of the disease?
Well, that's a good question. Right now, the titer, most importantly, is to help confirm the diagnosis. If you have a very high titer of 1 to 1,000, that's probably going to be MOGAD. There's very few false positives there. And then if you've got a low titer at 1 to 20, 1 to 40, this is at least on the Mayo kind of titer scale. All titers are a little bit different. Then you could certainly have false positives there. So that's where it's most important. Some studies have suggested that higher titer is associated with more severe attacks, but most studies have not found it to be associated with future risk of relapse or permanent disability. So I think clinically, it's probably the most important in terms of helping confirm the attack, but not quite as much for kind of what's going to happen in the future.
Got it. We got a question, and this kind of correlates to something I was also going to ask about. This person asks, following the first attack and steroid treatment of optic neuritis, what are the chances of relapse after the step-down process with the steroids? And I guess more broadly, are there any factors that help predict whether a person is likely to relapse or not following diagnosis?
Gosh, that's the million-dollar question, actually, is can we predict who's going to have a future relapse? Unfortunately, we haven't had a perfect test or perfect way of knowing who's going to relapse in the future. Overall, we think that about 50% of patients will relapse over time, but that means 50% of patients won't relapse over time. And so essentially, we do a slow prednisone taper, and then if they have a relapse when they come off, then, you know, they've got relapsing disease. I'd say the one predictive factor that's shared across all of them is that if you have relapsing disease, you're more likely to have another relapse. So if you've had two attacks, you're more likely to have a third or fourth attack. Whereas that first time, it's really hard. You know, some studies suggest, you know, all these various factors, but there hasn't been anything that's been consistent to say, okay, if you are, you know, 45-year-olds and you're female, and if you have this kind of attack and you have this titer, you're going to relapse. We haven't found that consistently across studies. Again, each one kind of shows kind of different things, but nothing as consistent. I would say, though, if you are a patient with relapsing disease, if you've had two attacks, it's a higher chance you're going to have a third attack, as opposed to if you've had one attack, the risk of that second attack is still about 50%.
Got it. Someone wrote in and asked, do people with MOGAD have non-epileptic seizures?
MOGAD itself doesn't cause non-epileptic seizures, but it can cause seizures, especially if you've got ADEM or cortical encephalitis inflammation in the brain. It can cause seizures, and it can cause epilepsy, like recurrent seizures. But the non-epileptic seizures, it doesn't cause by itself. The non-epileptic seizures are thought to be a functional neurologic condition where essentially it's not driven by abnormalities in the CNS signaling, but it's sometimes driven by stress or other things like that. And I think some patients who have had seizures from MOGAD, you know, it's possibly, you know, they've had the real seizures. Sometimes it can lead to these pseudo seizures or non-epileptic seizures that we call them. But itself, it doesn't drive non-epileptic seizures.
Got it. Thank you. Can vision be improved or even fully restored after damage caused from a MOGAD attack?
With a MOGAD attack, again, we're going to treat it aggressively with steroids, and then we may add on plasma exchange. And then after that attack, the majority of the recovery happens in the first 3 months, and then there can be some further recovery for a full year out. After a year after the attack, that's going to be your new baseline. And then, so if the question is, can it improve after the, you know, initially, the answer is definitely yes. The majority of attacks do improve. Now, if you're sitting at a year out and you still have a lot of damage in terms of function for that eye, at that point, we don't have good treatments. Sometimes my patients ask, you know, we did steroids, we did plasma exchange 3 months in, and my vision's still pretty bad. Can we just do plasma exchange again or IV steroids again? And it's unfortunately doesn't help. It's all those treatments are all in that first acute, you know, within the first 2 weeks, 4 weeks, that we're really trying to treat things and kind of calm down the inflammation. Again, whatever we have at 1 month, currently we don't have a way of regrowing the optic nerve, unfortunately. I think in the future there will be treatments like stem cells and other things to regenerate the optic nerve, but we're not there yet. If we have time, we can talk about kind of where we're at in terms of that technology. But I think the future will be, you know, regeneration of the optic nerve. We're just not there yet right now.
Yeah, I would love to talk about that some more. Maybe if we have time at the end, we can chat about it. Is MOGAD hereditary, and is there a chance I will pass on the MOGAD gene to future children?
Yeah, we don't think it's hereditary. There's been really not much of a signal of that right now, fortunately. It's an autoimmune process, and you know, there can be slight higher tendencies toward autoimmune disease in patients with MOGAD, but it's not a strong correlation with autoimmune disease. So really not very hereditary, not really going to be kind of passed on, or we don't see large families with MOGAD.
Got it. This person asks, I was diagnosed with MOG antibody disease and acute TM in November 2015. Their last blood test showed MOG antibody was negative. This person's neurologist suggested that they wean off of azathioprine. I'm probably saying that wrong. So, but their pain levels in their legs and feet have been quite bad, especially at night. They were wondering, is weaning off the medication causing their pain to worsen? What's the correlation there?
Yeah, I think, you know, residual pain, residual lack of function, things like that are from the actual prior transverse myelitis attack. The azathioprine, its job is to prevent new attacks. And so coming off those treatments don't worsen symptoms. Really, their job is to prevent new attacks. If any of these symptoms are new, you know, you'd want to get some imaging in the spine to make sure you don't have a new transverse myelitis attack. But if it's just the old symptoms coming off the azathioprine isn't going to worsen them. And so that's important. And in terms of the decision to come off or not, that's a good one too. And again, there's a lot of different ways to do it, but certainly we do try to often come off treatment if patients have been quiet for, you know, 3 years, 5 years. Especially if the antibody titers go to negative. About 75% of patients, the MOG antibodies titers will stay positive consistently. 25% will go to a level where they're not detectable. That doesn't mean they're not going to relapse again. Overall, again, we think that about 50% of patients will relapse. But if the antibody titers go to undetectable, we think the risk of relapse is about 10 to 20%. And so I think, again, if you've been on azathioprine and no new attacks for 5 years, it'd be quite reasonable to try coming off and seeing how you do. And then again, if you have a new attack, essentially it's very early steroids. And again, you have plasma exchanges, your backup plan, but very early steroids. So patients tend to do pretty well, actually, if they were to have a relapse the second time around, because you know what you're looking for. You're looking for optic neuritis, transverse myelitis, anything neurologic, and you can get those steroids right away. The first attack is the one that tends to cause the most disability because no one's thinking about optic neuritis or transverse myelitis. It often takes 1 or 2 or 3 weeks to even figure out that this is an inflammation in the brain. The steroids are delayed by 2 weeks. It's a little bit different where you know you've got MOGAD. You know you're coming off the azathioprine, so there's that potential risk of a relapse. You know, let's say it's 50%. If you have a new relapse, you treat right away, and then you do have to be on chronic immunotherapy for another 5 or 10 years, or, you know, kind of just depends on how aggressive the disease process is.
Got it. And that person then could potentially try to treat the pain separately.
Right. Yeah. So the pain separately, again, there's pain can happen after, especially after transvaginosis and MOGAD, and so you can treat it with things like Lyrica, gabapentin, other things to kind of calm down nerves.
Great. I guess kind of related to what you were just speaking about, someone asked how long should someone be on IVIG before they try Plaques to get better?
So this goes back to, this is now an acute attack. So an acute attack, essentially, we try the steroids first, and then usually we go to plasma exchange if they don't respond to steroids. Especially in children, though, we'll sometimes try IVIG. We try to do that probably all in that first month. And again, the timing of when to kind of go to these more aggressive treatments is quite unknown and unclear. But certainly, if it's a very severe attack, we'll probably start with 5 days of steroids. And then if they don't start turning the corner, we'll probably add on plasma exchange shortly after. That's typically how we do it here at the Mayo Clinic. It's reasonable to start with IV steroids and then give it 2 weeks. And then if you don't respond, then do plasma exchange. But in terms of these rescue treatments like plasma exchange or IVIG, it doesn't really help too much if they're 3 months out. You know, these are all treatments we're doing kind of in that first 1 to 2 months, ideally within the first month if we're going to do it. The problem is we don't know who's going to recover on the steroids alone. And that's what makes it very, very difficult. You know, if we had a crystal ball saying, well, if we give you steroids, you're going to get back to 20/20 without plasma exchange, obviously we would just kind of watch and wait. And if we knew that person was going to be destined to do poorly, we'd do plasma exchange right away. That's the hard part. And that's why, again, we're doing that timely PLEX randomized clinical trial to kind of look at the timing of PLEX. But it's tough. But again, if you're going to pull the trigger on one of these other treatments, usually in that first 4 to 6 weeks, we're doing it.
Got it. Someone just asked if it's possible that a COVID infection could be tied to an acute attack of either MOGAD or acute optic neuritis.
Yeah, we think so. Not COVID specific, but again, about a third of patients have some kind of a viral prodrome or some kind of infection that, again, ramps up the immune system. And with COVID being so common, that is a trigger. But we haven't seen, you know, with COVID coming in 2020, we didn't see this gigantic, huge peak in MOGAD. So it's clearly not 100% tied by any means. But again, it's any kind of infection that can ramp up the immune system can potentially trigger MOGAD. So we do see some.
Right. This person, I know you kind of briefly mentioned that there is a potential tie between MOG antibody disease and acute disseminated encephalomyelitis or ADEM. If MOG was not present at the time of an ADEM attack, is it possible that it could be present in the future? And is it worthwhile to monitor MOG levels via blood tests going forward?
Well, that's a good question. Again, during that acute attack of any kind, sometimes you're getting steroids or plasma exchange, and you know that could potentially influence things. So it's definitely worth checking at least one more time. Beyond that, it's probably not worth checking MOG antibodies every year to see if you're going to become MOG positive. The rate of that's quite low. So I would say, you know, check during the acute attack. Check again maybe one more time if this clinical picture was suspicious for MOG and you were negative. And then what I would do is essentially if you have any new attacks of any kind, whether it's ADEM, transvaginosis, optic neuritis, anything inflammatory in the brain, then check for the MOG antibodies. And then lastly, if you have recurring attacks and the blood keeps being negative, the last thing that you could check is actually check for MOG antibodies in the spinal fluid. So doing a spinal tap or lumbar puncture. At the Mayo Clinic, we can check for MOG antibodies in the spinal fluid under research purposes, but there's been studies around the world, including the Mayo Clinic, where we think that up to 10% of patients who are negative in the blood for MOG can actually be positive for MOG antibodies in the spinal fluid and help clinch a diagnosis of MOGAD. But always start with the blood first, much easier to do, much, I think, more established. But the spinal fluid is something, if a patient has recurrent attacks that look like MOG and they're negative in the blood, that's something that could be considered.
Got it. Thank you. Someone wrote in that their fatigue seems to be one of their most debilitating issues. Is there anything you can speak on to treatment for fatigue? Is this known to be related to MOG antibody disease? And are there any, is there any research going on in terms of the connection?
Yeah, I think there is an association with fatigue and prior inflammation, especially if MOGAD involved the brain. So the ADEM or cortical encephalitis, definitely an association with fatigue. It's hard though to quantify, and which makes it hard to study. I think that a couple of things that would be important to do if fatigue is actually one of the largest factors is to make sure that there's nothing else also contributing to the fatigue. So that'd be checking for sleep apnea, checking thyroid levels. Now, other things that can cause fatigue too, and not just automatically blame it on the MOGAD. Obviously, if those were all normal and you had a prior episode of ADEM or cortical encephalitis, inflammation of the brain, it probably is tied in. But I'd say that's one of the harder parts of research in MOGAD, for sure, is the fatigue, just because it's hard to quantify and define.
Thank you. Someone asked, can a diagnosis of MOGAD affect life expectancy? What is the prognosis for someone with MOGAD?
Yeah, we don't currently think it will affect life expectancy, but it really kind of depends on the type of attack and how much disability is remaining from the attack. So the good part is, unlike multiple sclerosis, with MS, you can get these recurrent attacks where you're symptomatic, but also even when you're not symptomatic, you can get this progressive phase where essentially patients can have this steady decline, even though they're not having discrete attacks. With MOG, we don't think there are these invisible attacks. So all the disability is driven by symptomatic attacks that you notice. And so that allows you to escalate therapy and prevent new attacks. There's not this visible progressive phase for MOGAD. So we don't think it'll affect life expectancy overall. But of course, if you had a very severe transverse myelitis attack and you're wheelchair bound, or, you know, it's, things are tough, you know, then you might be more prone to infections, that kind of thing. But just disease itself, let's say you had an optic neuritis with it, it shouldn't affect life expectancy.
Got it. Thank you. Someone asked, when I have a flare or a relapse, I usually get inflammation in my ears. Tinnitus, such as whooshing noises and then beeping noises that block my ear. Can this be related to MOG?
That's interesting. It's not a common symptom that I've really heard of very much. Sometimes with MOG attacks, you can get raised pressure in the brain. And a symptom of raised pressure in the brain can be this whooshing noise that syncs up with your heartbeat. It's called pulsatile tinnitus. And so maybe that's how it could be connected. But otherwise, we don't tend to think of it causing any pulsatile hearing changes. But again, if there's raised intracranial pressure, raised pressure in the brain, that can, it can cause pulsatile tinnitus. So maybe it's driving it through that. Again, with, you know, the important part is, if you have new symptoms, you'd want to have some kind of way of objectively showing that there's inflammation. That's usually an MRI, or if it's optic neuritis, it's, you know, an OCT image, or the pupil doesn't respond as well to light, those kinds of things.
Got it. When asked, getting MOGAD as a child, are there any special concerns, like maybe puberty or anything that the pediatric MOGAD is specific to?
With, again, MOGAD does cause a good amount, explains a good amount of inflammation in children. Fortunately, the attacks tend to recover a little bit better than adults. And we do think the relapse rates in children is lower than adults. It shouldn't affect puberty or any of those kinds of things unless the patient had inflammation of the hypothalamus. So the hypothalamus is a part of the brain that's involved in hormone function. It secretes hormones and growth hormones to allow you to grow, those kinds of things. So if you had inflammation of the hypothalamus or parts of that system, then it could be involved. But otherwise, if it's, let's say, an isolated optic neuritis attack, it should have no problems with just normal development growth.
I'm going to ask, for family planning purposes, are there any special concerns for pregnancy if I have had MOGAD in the past? And are there concerns with being on an IVIG while trying to get pregnant?
No, that's a good question. In terms of pregnancy, the pregnancy itself is thought to actually potentially decrease the risk of relapse in MOGAD while you're pregnant. Essentially, you have, the fetus that's growing, and your body does not want to, reject the fetus. And so it actually suppresses the immune system somewhat. And so that's something to keep in mind. That part's okay. After delivery, there's always the potential for relapse at that point. So that's something to look for. In terms of, I'd say the biggest thing though is treatments. Some treatments that are you can't do during pregnancy. For IVIG specifically, that one you is probably safe during pregnancy, so that part's okay. But it all just kind of depends. The biggest impact in terms of pregnancy is kind of what treatments we can do, and some we can't do, and some we can do.
Got it. Thank you. So we mentioned earlier about the research. I think we do have some time if you want to talk more about that and what's to look forward to in the future.
Yeah, maybe we can talk about the randomized clinical trial for plasma exchange. It's called TIMELY-PLEX, and essentially we're taking any patient with severe optic neuritis or severe transverse myelitis. And right now, the big question is, does plasma exchange work? And if so, when do we do it? Do we do it right away, or do we do it only if they don't respond to steroids? And so essentially, if you've got severe optic neuritis or severe transverse myelitis, if you're part of the clinical trial, you get randomized to either getting steroids alone or steroids and plasma exchange at the exact same time. And then we can look at the outcomes. If you were randomized to steroids alone, if you don't recover in 1 to 2 weeks, then you get this delayed rescue PLEX. And so hopefully that'll help us inform us in terms of when we should be doing this treatment. If plasma exchange was as easy as taking a pill of aspirin, we would just do it right off the bat. But it's pretty involved. It requires a central line, oftentimes 5 treatments every other day. So again, it's pretty involved. But if it is early, treatment is pivotal to leading to better outcomes, we would do it right away. If we can wait 1 to 2 weeks, we would probably delay. And so this will inform how we move going forward, because right now, every center does it differently. Some, do very early plasma exchange, some don't use it much at all. And so it's really a hodgepodge in terms of what we do, and this will help consolidate and guide us with actually clinical data. And we have 31 sites enrolling, soon to be enrolling around the US. Again, Johns Hopkins, Alastair Toklas, he's an immunologist there. We're kind of co-leading it together. And then we have eventually by August, we'll have 31 sites recruiting for this. So hopefully this will really help us in terms of helping gauge kind of treatments. And this will be for MOG patients, NMO, MS, really any patient with kind of severe attacks will be eligible for this trial. So that's one avenue of research. I think, there's a question about, is there anything we can do to kind of recover vision after these attacks? And I do think the future will be stem cells. Right now, we can actually take, skin and grow optic nerves in a dish. So we can do it what we call in vitro. The problem is we don't know how to make these optic nerve stem cells grow to where they're supposed to grow. So essentially, the very first connection for the optic nerve is actually from your eyeball to the middle of your brain is the very first connection. It actually has to go that far before it makes its first connection. And we don't know how to make those nerves grow to where they're supposed to grow. And so that's kind of the barrier right now. But there's a lot of animal studies trying to figure that out. I know at UC Irvine, and Stanford, they're doing studies to try and get the axons of the optic nerve to go in actually the correct direction. Some are using electromagnetic waves to try and get them to go where they're supposed to go. So again, the hope is to direct them in an animal model. And then once we have it working in animals, then it's something that will apply to humans. Maybe want to caution some of the audience, there are stem cell clinics out there where they will inject optic nerve stem cells into your eye, but there hasn't been any great data on, how that's going to work because we don't know how to make those optic nerves go to where they're supposed to go. The drawback of that kind of therapy right now is one, there's not great evidence that it would work. And then two, there have been reports of patients developing a lot of inflammation in the eye from the injections and actually even going blind from the injections. So I wouldn't, even if you had, $1 billion, I wouldn't recommend that treatment right now until we get it working in animals and then, clinical trials in humans. But right now, I wouldn't recommend any of those stem cell clinics right now, unfortunately.
Very interesting. Well, thank you for sharing, and we are excited to hear about the results when they come in, especially about the study that you and Dr. Satirtris are conducting. And we can also put information about that study if you'd like on our clinical trials and studies pages on our SRNA's website. Also, I would just recommend to anyone interested in getting involved in research can always check. If you're located in the US, you can check clinicaltrials.gov and just search, MOG antibody disease or whatever you are interested in doing research on. But thank you so much for sharing. And I'd hope to have you on in the future to talk about the developments from your findings.
Oh, absolutely. It was a lot of fun having a chance to chat with all of you, especially with MOG Awareness Month in April.
Yes. We are having a few MOGAD Awareness Month events, and we've partnered with the MOG Project as well to put together some resources and other events. So look out for that the rest of this month. We don't have any more questions, so I think we can probably end early unless anyone else has any questions in the chat. I'll give it a minute. But thank you so much, Dr. Chen, and we really appreciate your volunteering to come on and share your expertise.
I really enjoyed it. And if any questions come up later, I'm sure you can reach out to SRNA and I'd be happy to answer them.
Awesome. Yes, you can always email us. We're at info@wearesrna.org. Can find more information on our website, wearesrna.org. Happy to try and help answer any questions anyone might have now and in the future. Right. Thank you so much, and I enjoy the rest of your day.
Great. Thank you, everyone. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you to our Ask the Expert sponsors, Amgen, Alexion AstraZeneca Rare Disease, Genentech, and UCB. Amgen is focused on the discovery, development, and commercialization of medicines that address critical needs for people impacted by rare, autoimmune, and severe inflammatory diseases. They apply scientific expertise and courage to bring clinically meaningful therapies to patients. Amgen believes science and compassion must work together to transform lives. Alexion AstraZeneca Rare Disease is a global biopharmaceutical company focused on serving patients with severe and rare disorders through the innovation, development, and commercialization of life-transforming therapeutic products. Their goal is to deliver medical breakthroughs where none currently exist, and they are committed to ensuring that patient perspective and community engagement are always at the forefront of their work. Founded more than 40 years ago, Genentech is a leading biotechnology company that discovers, develops, manufactures, and commercializes medicines to treat patients with serious and life-threatening medical conditions. The company, a member of the Roche Group, has headquarters in South San Francisco, California. For additional information about the company, please visit www.gene.com. UCB innovates and delivers solutions that make real improvements for people living with severe diseases. They partner with and listen to patients, caregivers, and stakeholders across the healthcare system to identify promising innovations that create valuable health solutions.